Welcome back, everyone, to From the Yarra River to the Mediterranean Sea. As always, you are joined by me. My name is Hannah. I'm joining you from Melbourne, also known as Naam in Australia. And we have Itai joining us from Jerusalem. Hi, Itai.
Hi, also known as Al-Quds and Yerushalayim. It's good to be here.
Yes, I love that we've added that in now. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge that I am recording this podcast on unceded Wurundjeri land, and I pay my deepest respects to elders past and present. This was and always will be Aboriginal land. So Itai, we last spoke with Ma'oz Inon in that beautiful discussion, and I wanted to come back and record just the two of us for this episode because I wanted to touch on the naive but good constructive plan that he spoke about called A Land for All. And it's something that we have spoken about before on the podcast. And I think we kind of, when we first started doing this podcast, we had this skeleton of what we were going to do. We had 5 episodes planned and this was going to be the last episode as like a final, this is our solution. But since then, obviously, things have changed. We've got amazing guests. It's been a really great experience. But I think we can't do this as the last episode. I think we should talk about it now, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay. So how do you want to start? You want to talk about what A Land for All is?
Well, before I want to talk about A Land for All, which is a confederation, I actually want to talk about some other solutions that are around. And then I'll finish with A Land for All, if that's okay. So
yeah, that
the
sounds
first...
good.
The first solution, I don't really like the word solution, but plan, I guess, that we can use is one from Benjamin Netanyahu. On day 104 of the war, he was asked, "What's your plan?" And he said in a press conference in Hebrew, "Israel must control the entire area from the river to the sea." And then asked, "What are you going to tell Joe Biden, who wants a two-state solution?" And he said, "Sometimes you need to say no, even to your best friends." And the one-state solution that Netanyahu was talking about, where Israel controls the entire area from the river to the sea, is the current reality that we have today. And in his comments on that, Netanyahu said that he feels that every time Israel withdraws from territory, it reduces Israel's security. So the only way for Israel to be safe is to occupy as much territory. Of course, I would say what he forgets is that when we withdrew from the Sinai, after many bloody wars with Egypt that killed thousands of both Israeli and Egyptian lives, Israel became much safer. When Israel signed a peace agreement with Jordan, Israel became much safer. Even the peace agreements Netanyahu signed with the UAE and Bahrain as part of the Abraham Accords also in some ways, you know, increased Israeli security and flourishing. So, you know, the idea that Israeli security only comes from occupying territory, I think, is a very dangerous idea, but that's the current idea held by the Israeli government.
Mm. Interesting. It's so interesting because I remember during this war, like all of us were like, what is the plan for the day after? And so many people were like, you know, the plan is not to continue to control Gaza. The plan is to just get rid of Hamas, whatever that means, and then it goes back to the status quo. But I think the whole thing that people are forgetting is that the status quo was not good for Palestinians. It is not good for Palestinians. So we can't just, you know, deal with this in isolation and be like, okay, now let's go back to basically what is this one-state solution where, yes, some Palestinians have Israeli citizenship. We spoke about this in one of our previous episodes, but there is this whole, you know, the West Bank and Gaza, which is part of this one-state solution, but actually not really.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk actually about the Palestinian one-state solution, which is often called, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, or free Palestine. You know, there's lots of slogans that support this Palestinian one-state solution. And the idea of this as a solution is that there's a Palestinian government that controls the entire territory, that all Palestinians who were expelled in 1948 are able to return to their homes, and that Palestine becomes... you know, a state that would be obviously a lot more Muslim than Jewish in orientation, and the flag would be a Palestinian flag, the national language would be Arabic. And a lot of Jews fear that one-state solution if it's just Palestine, for the same reason I think Palestinians fear the current reality, because a lot of Jews fear that what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, if there was a one-state Palestine, the Palestinians would do that to Israelis. Some Palestinians say that's not what would happen in a one-state solution. That would be a democracy, you know, one person, one vote, and you would have an Arab majority, and Jews would exist as a minority here in the same way Jews existed as a minority in, you know, many other countries in the world. But Jewish Israelis very much fear that idea of being a minority in Israel, because they feel that as part of what's essential to their security is being a majority in this country. But there's definitely growing talk now for a one-state solution as Palestine as well on the Palestinian side, in the same way that there's growing support for the one-state solution on the Israeli side, as reflected by the current Israeli government. But in my opinion, I think both those two solutions are non-starters. So I want to move on.
Before we move on, I just want to ask your opinion on that. So why do you think, let's say it was a one-state solution where there's not necessarily a guaranteed Jewish government or a Palestinian guaranteed government. What if it is, like you said, one person, one vote? There are lots of different parties. There could be, you know, a right-wing Jewish party. There could be a really progressive Jewish party. There could be Palestinian parties. There could be a mixed Jewish-Palestinian standing together, becoming a political party kind of thing.
Love that.
What is the problem with that?
I think Israeli and Palestinian people are deeply nationalistic people, and both of us want our own flags and our own anthem and our own national holidays as public holidays and our own people to lead our country. And we currently, unfortunately, hate each other. And so the idea of saying these two people that have, you know, just fought, you know, one of the most violent wars since 1948, just share everything together. I'd love to see that. You know, I think it would be amazing, but we're not there yet. I don't think it's fair to ask Israelis to give up on their nationalism in the same way I don't think it's fair to ask Palestinians to give up on their nationalism. And a one-state reality, whether that one state is Israel or whether that one state is Palestine, asks the other side to give up on their dream of a homeland. And to me, that's not a fair solution.
Okay. Right, so then we go to the two states then. If we can't ask one group to give up their nationalism, then one of the other solutions is, all right, then we'll have a two-state solution.
Right, so a two-state solution is favoured by the US, the EU, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Germany, like lots of countries around the world favour a two-state solution. And the idea is exactly as you said, well, one state Israel doesn't work, one state Palestine doesn't work, let's make two states where more or less Gaza and the West Bank is Palestine and the rest of the country is Israel. There's something called the Geneva Accord or the Geneva Initiative that was a negotiated two-state solution in 2003 that has maps and explains how this would all happen and what happens with refugees in Jerusalem and water, which is, it's a really interesting plan, was never implemented. And there's a group still lobbying for that in Israel and Palestine. And it's also the position of Fatah, of Mahmoud Abbas, supports a two-state solution. And it's also the position of the Arab parties within Israel to support a two-state solution. To me, I see the two-state solution as a divorce. I see it as kind of, we don't get along, let's put a big wall between us. You're on one side, I'm on the other side, and that's how we live. And I know you're a family lawyer, so you've seen a lot of divorces that have been solved by people living in separate houses. And I think in theory, again, great idea in theory, but it ignores a very, very practical reality in that we live amongst each other. There are many, many Arabs who live in Israel. There are many, many Jews who live in the occupied Palestinian territories of the West Bank. Jerusalem. Jerusalem is currently a mixed city and obviously half of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city that under a two-state solution would have to be divided, but Jerusalem is a very mixed city in terms of its population. And so the idea of separation maybe was possible if a two-state solution happened, you know, a few moments after 1967. But I also think today, given how mixed the two populations are, a two-state solution is very unrealistic. It's sort of like me sort of making a scrambled egg and then you telling me to unscramble the white and the yolk. Like, not going to work. Like, it's the egg is scrambled.
In That's, the family law comparison, it's like what we call separated under the one roof. So you're not together, but you're still living in the same house. And you can see why no one would want to do that. Because if you're divorcing, you want to divorce and move on with your life and never have to see each other again. But that doesn't work when there's nowhere else for those two people to go. They have to be in this house. They want to be separated. They want to have their own identities. But yeah, if you're seeing each other every day, you can see why it would cause tensions.
Absolutely. Which brings us on to the solution that Ozinon spoke about and also Mushon Zeraviv and I support as well, which is called a confederation. When you hear the word confederation, what does that sound like to you?
I don't know what a confederation is. I know what a federation is because that's what Australia is. There were, you know, before we became a federation, there were states of Australia, and then eventually there was like, okay, we should become one federation with one government, but still have separate states, and there's difference between like what laws the federal government makes and the state governments. Is that, I don't know what a confederation is though.
Yeah, so Australia is a federation that happened in 1901. WA wasn't thrilled about it. I think some people in WA still aren't thrilled about it. but yeah, Australia managed to create a federation without a war, which is very different from the US that had a huge war before they created their union of states. And there was a conflict actually, interestingly, in Australia about where the capital would be, because some people wanted it to be in Melbourne and some people wanted it to be in Sydney. And typical Australians who, you know, didn't want to upset the Victorians or the New South Wales, they created this whole entire other city called Canberra to kind of resolve that that compromise. And so that's why Canberra exists, actually, because it should have been Melbourne, but that was initially the capital. So the question is, if we were to go to a federation, what would it look like? So there is a movement in Australia, called the Federation Movement, and they propose creating 30 cantons in Israel, where there would be 20 that have Jewish majorities and 10 that have Arab majorities. And this would extend from the river to the sea, and each would then have its own powers to create policy in its own canton, its own region. So say Bnei Brak, which would be Haredi, would have a Haredi school system and that sort of character, and Nazareth or Baka al-Galbiya would be Arab in nature, and Tel Aviv would be secular in nature. And the idea was you'd have these kind of like bolstered local councils for this federation model. But the big problem with the federation model is, one, it doesn't include Gaza, and two, it keeps the state exclusively Jewish in nature. So there's no Palestinian state, because the idea of 20 cantons with a Jewish majority and 10 with an Arab majority would always mean that the state will always have a Jewish character. So it means that there's no expression of Palestinian nationalism or Palestinian identity.
Can I just ask, what's the plan for Gaza then?
So this is the big problem with the federation movement. It doesn't have a plan for Gaza. It just sort of ignores it. And it Gaza just exists as its own entity that's not part of this federation. But we can see what happens when you ignore Gaza. So that's why I think that solution's a non-starter. But I just want to mention it because I know some people support it. Right. But I think the solution that that Ma'oz supports is called a confederation. Some people also call it two states, one homeland. There's an organization that supports it called A Land for All that have a website devoted to promoting this idea. And we've had quite a few guests that have supported this idea, including Mushon Zeraviv, and Ma'oz and myself. And I think it's not the dominant solution at the moment that people talk about, but it's a solution that I find very interesting because it explicitly deals with the three problems that I mentioned. So the problem that I mentioned with the one-state solution, Israel, is that there's no Palestinian homeland. The problem with one-state Palestine is that there's no Israeli homeland. The problem with federation is it also includes no Palestinian state. And ultimately, both Israelis and Palestinians want to have their state. But as we mentioned, two-state doesn't work because you can't unscramble an egg. So what does A Land for All do? A Land for All says from the river to the sea is Israel, and from the river to the sea is Palestine. So that there's two states, But everyone is allowed to live wherever they want. So Palestinians can live wherever they like, anywhere between the river and the sea, so can Jews. But within that region, there are two states. There's a state called Israel, there's a state called Palestine, and then you can live in the state of the other person, but you can't vote in the other state of the person. So in the same way that I could be an Australian and I can live in New Zealand, I can't vote in New Zealand. If I'm not a New Zealand citizen, I can live there. Mm. And so a Jew who would be living, let's say, in the West Bank would be able to live there under Palestinian rules, and they'd have to pay Palestinian taxes and all of those sorts of things because they'd be in Palestine, but they would only vote in Israel. And a Palestinian, if they wanted to live within inside Israel, they could do that, but they could only vote within the Palestinian state, which would be in Gaza and the West Bank. Another idea.
Sorry, ask you a question on that. Two questions. One, is it kind of like a permanent resident like we have in Australia? So you're not a citizen, you can't vote, but you're allowed to permanently live in Australia. Would it be the same like that?
Yes, kind of like that. Like, as in you live in another state and you have, you know, certain rights within that state because you live there and you'd pay taxes in that state, but the place where you vote, you can only vote in one of the states. You can't vote in both of them, and you choose whether you want to vote in the Israeli state or the Palestinian state. And those two states would become very independent into one another because you would have a lot of people living in the other state in the same way that you have a lot of Victorians living in New South Wales and vice versa. Mm-hmm. People would cross the border all the time. And at the moment, we have very hard borders between, you know, Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, walls, checkpoints, all of these sorts of things. And the way at the moment a Palestinian can enter Israel is they have to have a reason. So you have to apply for something called a permit. And there's 99 different permits that Palestinians need to apply for to come into Israel. There's one for work, one for travel, one for marriage, one to open a business, all of these sorts of things. And under a land for all, the permit system would be flipped to, instead of needing a permit to do everything, you'd only need a permit if you already have a criminal record. So everyone would be allowed in, but the people, you know, with criminal records wouldn't be, or would have to apply or go through a process. So it would be an inclusion policy rather than an exclusion policy. So the default is, if you've done nothing wrong, you can go, both Jews and Palestinians can go into each other's countries. If you have got a record or something that's of concern to security people, then you would need to apply for a permit. And each state would then be kind of mixed in with one another. So there wouldn't be a hard border. There would be obviously security, you know, between them, but there'd be certain things that would be shared because it's one state. There might be a shared airport, there'd probably be a shared currency, I'm sure. There'd probably be shared defense policy. There'd probably be shared security, taxation, those sorts of things. And the idea of the states being independent to one another is kind of like a bit like the EU, because if one state would fall, it would affect the other one. So let's say, like currently in the EU, when Greece has an economic problem, it's no longer just Greece's problem. It's also Germany's problem, and it's also France's problem, because Greece falling affects the whole EU because they've got a shared currency. And so the idea here is that you would create all sorts of mechanisms of interdependence where one state relies on the other state for its well-being, and that way they have an interest in strengthening the other state, strengthening the trade, strengthening the education, all of those sorts of things. Now, I'll just say a few problems with a land for all, because I know I'm going to get letters about this. A big problem is that Israel's GDP is currently one of the top 20 GDPs in the world, and Palestine's GDP is one of the bottom 20s in the world. So you're talking about merging two countries with very, very different economies, and obviously with a long, long history of war and conflict and a deep level of distrust. A lot of people look at this and say, how can you do this? Like, this is, you're living in fantasy land. Like, yes, the EU is lovely, but you know, we're currently in World War II. Like, we're not where the EU is today. And even with the EU, we know that there's a lot of problems with it. And there's various countries that want to leave the EU, and Britain left the EU as well a couple of years ago. So I'm very aware of these challenges, because the key ingredient for a land for all to work is trust. for people to say, I want to share this land with someone else, and I believe that that's possible. And at the moment, most people don't want to share this land, and most people don't believe this is possible. So before a land for all can even be, let's say we want to get to a land for all in 20 years. There's a lot of work that you need to do before you can get there.
Yeah, well, I think that was one of the reasons why when we were initially talking about this podcast, we wanted to do this solution at the end, is because everything that we've had leading up to it is what needs to happen before this solution can be put into place. You know, you need to have empathy for the other person. You need to have trust, and you need to have hope. And I think it is like really nice for us to be able to say, these are our solutions. But exactly what you said, we can't have the solution until all of these other things are put in place.
Yeah. And this is what we talk about a lot in peace building, that for grassroots efforts to work, like, you know, we're doing Kids for Peace, Seeds of Peace, those sorts of things, you need a political process. And for a political process to work, you need grassroots. So you can't have two leaders making peace and the people not being behind them. That's not going to work. And you can't have the people, you know, wanting a certain solution and then no leaders are supporting it. So you need both. And so, you know, I see my job as working on the grassroots. I'm not a politician. And I think the politicians have to work on, you know, doing that on a political level, both in Israel and Palestine. And then I think there's some way to talk to. And these processes take a really, really long time. But these things happen. And they've happened in our lifetime. It happened in Northern Ireland. It happened in South Africa. I sometimes even use the example of the LGBT rights movement. You know, in the 1970s, in the 1980s, you couldn't be gay and in public. You know, being gay in public was made you ostracized, and it made you couldn't even come out to your parents in some cases. And now, thankfully, in most Western liberal countries, you can be openly queer and it's fine. Like, it's people accept you for it, and that change happened through 40 years of advocacy, of seeing same-sex couples on TV and seeing different kind of relationships in our own families. And probably most people who are listening to this podcast are either queer themselves or know someone who is queer, and that's like, it's not a secret anymore. In the 1970s and 80s, no one knew someone queer because you couldn't come out. And I feel like the peace movement in Israel-Palestine, it's kind of in the closet at the moment. It's like, it's scary to come out. It's scary to tell your friends and your loved ones that you believe in this idea, because people go, you're crazy. The other side want to kill us. There's no partner for peace. And I'm like, of course there's no partner for peace. There's no partner for peace because I look at Palestine and I see Hamas, and Palestine looks at Israel and they see Netanyahu. And then they're like, all right, well, what am I going to do? There's no one to talk to. So, we've created this feedback loop where the other side sees the most extreme version of the other side and therefore adopts the most extreme policies and the most extreme violence, because they think the only thing I can do when opposite me is this very, you know, extreme ideology is adopt an extreme ideology myself. And so what needs to happen is we need to start seeing each other not at each other's worst, but at each other's best. And that means, for me, amplifying voices of minorities, amplifying voices of peace builders, amplifying the people that are still in the closet, and helping them to come out. And that's what we're trying to do on this podcast, to say there are these people, there are these peace movements, there are these, you know, grassroots dialogue groups that I go to all the time that sometimes only have 10 people at them. But these are the people that are trying to say, okay, we want something to be different in 20 years. So let's start working now to create a change that can bear fruit in the future.
I love that. And I think honestly, like, the first step is, like you said, to come out. The first step is to be like, I believe in a better future. I believe in a world and an Israel-Palestine where we can all live together. And I think, you know, I mentioned in the first episode, like, I don't need to have the solutions. I just need to have that belief. That's like the first step of it, of what we all need to do. And there's this quote that I've been thinking about since the beginning of this war. Like, you know, there's no point. The quote is, there's no point in doing anything. I'm just one person, said 7 billion people. And right. I think of that. I think, like, imagine if 7 billion people, the entire world, just had the belief. I can imagine a world where we are all free, where we are all autonomous, where we all live peacefully. Like, even just having that thought, and not only like my people being free, my people being safe, like actually everyone is free and safe and autonomous. That's like the first part of this, believing that that can actually be a reality. Once we all start to believe that, then the next steps can come.
So there's a huge impediment to that, and it's something called nationalism. When yes. you hear the word nationalism, what comes to your mind?
Well, I think about like the flags, you know, that's mm-hmm. kind of why I don't love either of the pro-Palestine or pro-Israel rallies, because they're so nationalistic. They're like, you know, the flag in your face. Like, I don't feel nationalistic about Australia either. I love living here, but like, ugh, seeing the Australian flag is just like gross to me. Like, it's just, yeah, I don't, when I hear the word nationalism, I have like this repulsion, but I don't necessarily mm-hmm. know why.
So I am also not a fan of nationalism, but I also know that nation states have been incredible for giving humans rights, because when humans organize in the form of a state, they usually get a government, they usually get a constitution. Sometimes if they're lucky, they get a human rights charter. If they're really lucky, they get a legal system that protects their rights. And if they're not citizens of a state, they don't have any of those rights. So for me, I think that even though nationalism has been awful, nationalism has done incredible things to protect humans. The problem with nationalism is that that same vehicle that can give you rights can also take away those rights. And so we know that there's many states, nation states, probably Iran is the best example, where the state uses its power to deny its own citizens many of its basic rights, or states that are at war with other states then use, you know, their power to dominate another state. And that's why a lot of people hate nationalism. So to me, nationalism is both like a blessing and a curse.
So within nation states, I understand why, you know, the good thing about it is that people get rights. One thing I want to talk about within nation states is how those nation states are then governed. So there are democratic nation states, there are authoritarian nation states. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. So I obviously prefer liberal democratic nation states. That's my bias. They're my besties. But the nation states that don't have democracy, or that impose one religion on anyone, or that go to war with other people, are very, very dangerous nation states. North Korea, you know, there's many examples of them. And in the Middle East, we also have many ethno-national states as well. Ethno-national states are states that favor one ethnicity or one religion over another. So for example, Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan would favor Islam over other religions, and Islam would be in the constitution, and the courts in the country would be Sharia courts, and the character of the country would be Muslim favoring one ethnicity over another. Israel is a Jewish ethno-national state that favors Jews over non-Jews. There's many laws here, and the character of the state favors Jews over other religions. And then you've got like Nepal and India that favor either Hindu or Buddhism, or there's many Christian states as well in Europe, like Greece, for example, where the Greek Orthodox Church is embedded within the constitution as, you know, determining the character of the state. England with, you know, the Church of England and the royal family, etc. So there's many states that don't have this separation of religion and state like we do in Australia, where there is an ethnic character to the state. And a lot of those states say, well, this is the state for the Greek people or the German people, or Germany has a law of return as well, by the way. And so Israel says that this state is for the Jewish people. But then a lot of people say ethno-nationalism in 2024 doesn't make sense anymore, because, like you said, we want to live in a world where everyone is free and everyone can have their own identity expressed in their state. And when you have ethno-national states, you're imposing one identity on another. And that's like a big criticism of the Jewishness of Israel, which unfortunately is not a criticism of many other states who are ethno-national. And a lot of Jews feel that that is an unfair double standard, that ethno-nationalism is criticized in Israel in a way that it's not criticized in other states.
Well, I want to ask you about the criticism of ethno-national states, and specifically the Jewish ethno-national state. I'm not sure whether the criticism is criticizing the Jewishness of it or whether it's criticizing the Jewishness over a country that has half its population as not being Jewish. I think that's the criticism. Mm. And I was having this conversation yesterday about the fact that Israel became a Jewish ethno-national state in 1948. This is really like where this all started, the conflict aspect of it. Because again, I don't necessarily think the criticism is that Jews shouldn't have their own state. It's that Jews shouldn't have their own state in Israel. So my question to you is, after World War II, there were hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees after the Holocaust. Mm. And there was already this idea of Zionism, which we've spoken about in the first two episodes, that, you know, way before the Holocaust, there was this desire of people to go and live in their ancestral home in Jerusalem. And we spoke, in Israel. And we spoke about that process in the 1880s of people, the first Aliyah, a lot of them came from Russia, and we spoke about them purchasing land off absentee landlords and all of that discussion. If you're new here, go back and listen to episodes 1 and 2. So I have no problem with Jews who want to go and live in Israel because they have this pull for living in their ancestral homeland. I do have an issue with Zionism as a solution to anti-Semitism, because that is also what Zionism was. It wasn't only about wanting to live on the land, it was also, and this will be a way to save Jewish lives. As you said in those episodes, it wasn't very popular at the time. When it did become really, really popular was after the Holocaust, where there 6 million Jews were killed, along with, you know, millions of other people that weren't Jewish. And then there was this problem of what do we do with all of these Jewish refugees? And the world felt bad for what happened. And they said, you know what? All these Jews, they want to go to Israel now. We should create this state. What would have happened if, instead of saying to the Jews that had nowhere to go, okay, we will create this nation state in Israel for you. It will be a Jewish nation state and you will have your own autonomy and governments in this area. What if the UN had said, no, it shouldn't be the Palestinians that have to deal with that. It should be Germany. They were the ones that started this war. They were the ones who committed these atrocities against the Jews. You should halve Germany, split it or section off a little bit of Germany, give it to those Jews who now need a place to go, and that becomes the Jewish homeland. Now, I understand that people will say, yeah, but we don't want the homeland in Germany. We want the homeland in Israel. And my answer to that would be like, I understand that. Those who want to go to Israel can go. Just like a lot of people did before the Holocaust. People wanted to go to Israel, so they did. And they bought, purchased land and did things legally, and they were a minority in the land of Israel. But my point is that at the end of the day, there were all these refugees that just wanted to be safe. They didn't care where they were going. They just wanted to be safe. That's why so many of them went to Australia, went to South Africa, went to America. So why didn't we just create, like, if this is an issue of ethno-nationalism and having a Jewish state with Jewish people have the laws and run their country, why didn't they just say, okay, it should be in Germany where this all started, and all these refugees can now go to this little state that we can call Israel, which is in Germany, and it is a Jewish ethno-state? Why didn't that happen?
Mm-hmm. So three reasons why it didn't happen. The first is that Zionism predated the Holocaust by over 70 years. So, you know, the first Zionist Congress is in 1897, but even before that, there's already in the 1850s, you've got sort of proto-Zionist writings of Jews talking about, you know, influenced by the French Revolution, of saying we want, you know, after the French you know, had their revolution and liberty, democracy, egalitarianism. People like, we want that too. And you saw ethno-nationalism spread throughout the world as a result of the French Revolution and nation states being born across Europe. And I think Jews were very much influenced by that. And so I think the state of Israel was going to be born with or without the Holocaust. And I know a lot of people say, oh, the Holocaust is why, you know, the UN resolution went Israel's way. And I don't really buy that, because I think there was already 600,000 Jews in Israel before the end of World War II, before 1945.
600,000?
Yeah.
And, out of and a before, population of what?
Well, they were a minority. The total population, there was probably about 1.5 million Palestinians there as well at that time. Mm-hmm. But the state, the wheels of the state, the mechanisms of the state, the yeshuv, the Jewish councils, like all of that was in place well before the war. Like, the Jews had their own government and they had their own language and their own calendar. And, you know, there was essentially a state existing under the British mandate already. And had the Holocaust not happened, I think there would have just been many more Jews that could have lived in that state who would have, you know, not been killed in Europe. So I don't buy the argument that the Holocaust is what led to Israel. I do think though it changed the identity of many, many Jews who perhaps weren't Zionist before the war and then became Zionist after the war because they realized how essential it is. The second point is about, should you create a Jewish national home in Germany because Germany was responsible for World War II? Well, the issue is that the victims of the Holocaust weren't Germans. Many of the victims of the Holocaust were Poles and were Russians and were Swedes and were Danes and were Greek and were Italian. And in many of these countries, Ukraine especially, you know, the local population was involved in the murder and annihilation of Jews even more so than the Nazis. You know, sometimes the local population is the Hungary as well, you know, is the population that carried out the genocide. So it wasn't that just Jews wanted to return to Germany. It was, for many, many Jews, Europe in its entirety became an inhospitable place and a place of genocide and trauma. And so there was no desire to go back to these places.
I wanted to stop you on that point.
Majority of people were killed. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally get that. I knew you were going to bring that up and say, why would these Jews want to go back to live in Europe where they were just treated so horribly? Isn't that what we are asking the Palestinians to do now, even with the two states, one homeland solution? Aren't we asking the Palestinians to now live side by side with the people that have oppressed them for the last 75 years? Isn't that what we're doing?
Yeah, you're right. It is. And it's. I'm a hypocrite that I'm saying this, and I'm going to own that, because a lot of Palestinians say, rightly, I think, I don't want to live with Jews. I don't want to live with Israelis. I don't want to live with Zionists. Look what they do to my people. My ideal solution is, Hassan Nasrallah said this in a speech last week, you know, he said every Israeli has another passport. They should just take that other passport and go to the other country. And what he forgets is that while many Israelis, myself included, do have another passport, a lot of Israelis don't. And a lot of Israelis want to live here because of the dream of a Jewish national home that has been, you know, part of our identity for many, many generations. And they don't want to do that. And you're right that Zionism is something that exists at the expense of Palestinians. And it's why most Palestinians oppose Zionism, because they see the existence of a Jewish state as something that comes at their expense. And all of their interactions with Zionism have been very negative, and especially since October 7th, when we see what's happened in Gaza and the West Bank and how much suffering that has caused to Palestinians. And this is why I guess peace is so, so far away. I think there's a demographic reality, which is sort of the third point that I wanted to raise here, which is that even though maybe theoretically, you know, some of these other solutions might work, practically now between the river and the sea, there are about 7.3 million Jews and about 7 million Arabs. And those Arabs live in a mixture of, some of them are citizens of Israel, some of them are East Jerusalemites, some are in Gaza, some are in the West Bank. They've all got different rights. And the Jews all have more rights than those four groups of Palestinians. And those 14 million people now that live between the river and the sea, they're not going anywhere. Like, and anyone that dreams of sending all the Palestinians to Egypt or to Jordan is crazy. Anyone that dreams of sending those, 7.3 million Jews to somewhere in Europe or back to Iraq or to Yemen or to Turkey or to, all the places where we came from before 48 is crazy. Like, I know when India and Pakistan happened, there was mass population transfer. I don't want to see that happen. I don't think that's fair, and I don't think that's just. And we live now in a reality where, for various historic circumstances, Zionism and Palestinian nationalism have to coexist in the same land. And that's not fair to Palestinians. I understand that because, as you said, like, a lot of Palestinians say, why should we pay the price for this? But that's the reality. That's the demographics. I can't change those demographics, and I can't, I'm not going to convince millions of people to set up a Jewish state somewhere else, in the same way I'm not going to convince millions of Palestinians to set up a state somewhere else. So the demographic reality that's imposed on us is that we're about 50-50 in this land, and we need to share it.
I fully agree with that. So even in I wanted to bring it up and challenge you on that because I agree that right now this is the reality that we're in. But I think part of the reality, if we're going to go forward with this two states, one homeland, which I do believe in as well, I think that is the solution. I think in a part of that is reconciliation. We need to, if we want to live on this land, which we have to do, I don't see any other option. We have to acknowledge that Zionism came at the expense of the Palestinian people. Zionism as an ideology, the Zionism that I know now, that is a Jewish homeland in the state of Israel, it came at the expense of Palestinian people who literally had no say in whether or not the Jews had a homeland in that place. And I think in order, I think it was wrong. Like after learning everything that I have from the war, I think looking back, deciding the UN deciding to give the Jews their national homeland, I don't have an issue with a Jewish national homeland. Like ethno states are, as we discussed, like it's a problem in itself. Like there are so many ethno-religious states that to just criticize a Jewish one is ridiculous. And my dream is to abolish all religious ethno-national states and have every country as a liberal democracy. That's my little Maoz naive plan. But given that that's not going to happen, I think that having a Jewish ethno state is fine, given that there are so many others. But I think we have to acknowledge that putting it in the land of Israel in 1948 was the wrong thing to do. I don't have any issue with Jews going to live there. Like lots of Jews left the before the Holocaust, when there were all these warning signs, lots of Jews left and went to Palestine. And I have no issue with that. I have no issues with anyone living where they want to live, as long as they then abide by whoever's in control and, live peacefully with the people who live there. But I think that to not say, we are sorry that this happened, we are sorry about the pain that it caused you. We acknowledge that you took the responsibility for a whole group of people that you had nothing to do with, and we created a national homeland on your land. I think that is an important part of then moving forward and living together.
So I want to respond to that by sharing something very personal that you don't know about me. And because I don't want to give a political answer to that question, because I think it's a really important question, but I want to answer it from my heart. Do you know who the first baby that was born in Israel? Do you know the name of that person?
No.
It was my father. My father was the
No
first
way.
child born in the state of Israel. He was born 2 days after the Declaration of Independence in Petah Tikva. His name was Reuven Getzel, and his mother had come to Palestine in the 1930s, fleeing Germany. She was the only person in her family who came because she felt that something bad was about to happen in Germany, and she left, and she came as an 18-year-old to Kibbutz Hamadiyah. And because she left Germany, she survived, and the rest of her family didn't. And then my father was born as the first or one of the first children in this state. And had this state not existed, I wouldn't be alive today. Had my grandmother, Chava Albeck, not left Berlin and come to Palestine, I wouldn't be alive today. She would have been killed in the Holocaust and I would have never been born. And on my mother's side, my mother was born in Baghdad in Iraq, and she also came with her whole family in 1950 after basically all the Jews in Iraq were forced to leave. And so I'm the child of refugee grandparents. And for me, Israel is why I exist. Like, it's not something that's like an option or a luxury for me. It's something that is what, you know, if that historic event hadn't happened, I wouldn't be here today. And there are many, many Jews that are in the same situation as me. Now, I know very deeply to my core that this came at someone else's expense. I know that when the state of Israel was born, it essentially stopped what was here before, what was Palestine under the British mandate. It stopped being called Palestine and started being called Israel. And it also ended the dream of a Palestinian homeland. And I absolutely agree with you that before there is peace, when there is peace, definitely after there is peace, there needs to be a reconciliation process. And that Yom Ha'atzmaut, which is a day I celebrate because I'm happy that there is a Jewish national home, should also include elements in it that acknowledge the Nakba. There should be a moment of silence. There should be a memory of the people that died in order for this state to be created. I think when Israelis go to various places in this country, we don't know of all the names of the Palestinian villages that have been there before. I know there's a website called Zochot, and they have an app now that you can sort of look up where you are in Israel and it tells you what was the name of the Palestinian village before. I think it's really important to acknowledge country and acknowledge the people that were here before us, like we do on this podcast, because that's part of reconciliation, of saying we have a right to be here, but this came at someone else's expense. And if we want to share this country together, we need to acknowledge that this national movement didn't happen, you know, out of the blue. It happened as a result of the war, and it caused a lot of pain to a lot of people in 1948. But I will also say that I think there also needs to be Palestinian reconciliation towards Israelis, because while I very much support the idea of a national home for Palestinians, I think the way that Palestinians have gone about creating that home, in some cases using nonviolence, which is perfectly legitimate, but in other cases doing horrific acts of violence and terrorism against Jews. Obviously, October 7th is the most recent example, but there's many, many other examples of that. I think there also needs to be a Palestinian reckoning of the use of violence against civilians and terrorism and hijacking planes and blowing up buses and all of those sorts of things. And I think that's not, you know, I don't want the Palestinians to be people that think you can only build a state through violence, because when you build a state only through violence, you create a very violent and horrible state. Now, again, you're going to say I'm a hypocrite because Israel was built through violence. So how can I tell the Palestinians not to build a state through violence when we used an excessive amount of violence to build a state? And again, I'm going to own my hypocrisy and say it is hypocritical. And I don't like the fact that Israel was built through violence. And I don't want a Palestinian state to be built through violence. I don't want a state to come about because one brings the other to their knees. I want it to come about through negotiation and compromise, because I think that will ultimately create better states than states that come about through the total defeat of the other side.
That was so beautifully well said, and thank you so much for sharing with me and also our listeners, because it's not something I knew. And I think, yeah, part of reconciliation and building empathy and trust and all of these things is being vulnerable. And again, like, we are trying our best to model these really important values, and I just want to acknowledge that that's what you did now, and it's amazing. I always try and do that as well. it's really, really hard, but being vulnerable is like one of the core elements of all of this. So thank you for saying that. Thank you for this discussion as well. It's one that we've had, I reckon, maybe four times off microphone. Yeah. And I still learned.
Yeah.
And I still learned stuff in this conversation again.
What can people do if they have questions about this episode?
Good question, Itai. If people have questions, they can email us at fromtheyarra@gmail.com. And very excitingly, we have just started a new Instagram page. It is at fromtheyarra on Instagram. You can follow us there. We will be sharing updates about when new episodes are ready, but also much more. There are resources, ones that we have put in our episodes before. They will be on the Instagram page. Please check us out. If you want to ask us questions that way, we welcome that as well.
And yeah, just sending big hugs to all of our listeners. We really love you and thank you for being on this journey with us. And we wish you all peace, justice.